welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Portut. Hope everyone is doing good out there. Lots of activity going on here in the city of Atlanta with Final Four weekend in full swing. I'm actually going to head down there tomorrow and start my activities with helping out with the Final Four, so looking really forward to that. Also going to have, we're going to preview the Final Four matchups between Wichita State and Louisville and the other contests, Michigan and Syracuse. Also going to get into some MMA. I haven't done a power rankings in over a month, so I think we're long overdue to get my rankings done before we have a slew of events coming up over the next few weeks in April. Going to talk a little bit more about Mike Rice's firing from Rutgers. That was the big story over the past few days. He was relieved of his duties as the head men's basketball coach there. And also going to talk about some miscellaneous news and notes in women's basketball, Major League Baseball, and even some sports business news as well. So we're looking forward to talking with you for the next hour or so here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. We're going to take our first break, and when I come back, I'm going to preview the Final Four contest. You know, the beauty of doing your own podcast and incorporating new musics and new breaks is that you don't know how loud they're going to be or what the volume level is going to be when you're doing them sometimes. So we came with that Nas instrumental really hot with that one. That was a high volume there to start it off. But yeah, the reason I do these podcasts, the fans out there or listeners that have been listening to this for about a few months or so, you probably notice a few things. One, really not much editing. Whenever I have a guest or even just myself, come straight from the hip and talk directly through the show and incorporate the music breaks. And also, if there are some mistakes or follies, I will call myself out on them. So that was a fun one there, just making sure the volume was set. I think we're good right now for the next segment. And speaking of that, what we're going to do is I'm going to preview the Final Four action that's going to take place this weekend. And we reviewed the Sweet 16 and talked about what happened last weekend on my show back on Monday. So now I'm just going to focus more on the matchups. But interesting, I actually had to head into Atlanta or head into town or downtown. I live just outside of Atlanta, but you may as well just call it that area. But I had to head inside because I'm doing some volunteering and helping out with the PR staffs and everything like that. So I actually had to head into the city to get my information, get my uniform and everything like that. I literally was seeing them put up the signs yesterday for Wichita State and Louisville, Michigan, and Syracuse. So it's real quiet right now in downtown. But my first shift is tomorrow morning. So when I expect to get there tomorrow, I expect a lot more activity. But you can tell the city is starting to have more of an impact and more and feel the Final Four here. So really excited about heading down there and seeing some of the contests. And let's preview Wichita State and Louisville. Obviously, Wichita State got through the West region with some upsets that took care of Gonzaga and beat Ohio State in the Elite Eight. Those are probably their most known victories en route to Atlanta. And they're going to face Louisville, who had a really good run as well. Their highlight was probably defeating a Duke in the Elite Eight. Got a nice victory there, and they're going to face off in the first semifinal. I think this contest, I'm going to take Louisville. I've been on Louisville's bandwagon, or I've been really liking them ever since towards the end of the season and the final and the winning the Big East tournament. I think their guard player Russ Smith and a Silva is going to be too much for Wichita State to handle. And I think even with the injury on the court of Kevin Ware, we've all been inundated with the injury and the reaction. Even I did a commentary on in the last podcast of how it was covered and how it was handled and just the shocking nature of it. Just looking on the court, he was a valuable bench player for them and gave him about 20 minutes a game, caused a few turnovers in the contest and gave him some depth in the backcourt. So they're going to feel the effects of that physically actually on the court, besides the obvious emotional situation. And by the way, along with that, I was really disappointed in seeing Louisville selling, or I guess Adidas slash Louisville, selling the shirts with his number on the back of it, number 5, I guess, rise to the occasion or whatever. Just another example of the blatant disrespect and commercialism of a game that's supposed to be about amateurs. I don't understand how you can have take advantage of the man's injury, and he's hopefully going to recover and have the surgery and everything like that, and it looks like he's going to be back on the court, you know, in a lengthy amount of time, but it looks like he's going to have a good option or good chances of returning. I don't understand how you're going to sell shirts with his number on the back of it and use that as a ploy just to gain more money. Now, the fans of this show know I'm not a fan of Adidas and all of, especially on the college front, and all the alternate uniforms, and Louisville's looks hideous, by the way. The white ones from the very beginning, they've been awful. And having to see that, another example of how they take advantage of an injury of a player and use it to, you know, line their own pockets was appalling. And I saw that in the end, or there was a report that they're going to donate some of the money, or Adidas or Louisville, whatever, they're going to donate some of it to some university funds or scholarship funds or whatever, you know, and that's just a slap in the face too. Are you going to donate to the university funds? Pay for that man. If you really want to make it right, you know, pay for that man's recovery and his injury. And now some of you are saying, oh, he's in college and they're going to take care of his insurance and everything. Yeah, bull crap. What if he doesn't make it to the NBA and play professionally? Is he going to see a dime of that money? Absolutely not. I'd rather them just donate it to a charity in Louisville or something like that. I'd rather them do that than to say, or give it to the university. The university has already making millions off of these players. So that was really disgusting, you know, how Adidas and Louisville have merged to take advantage of the athletes once again. So that'll be another topic for another day to really get into the fake amateurism of college athletics. But back to on the court, as I said, I think Louisville's going to win that game, and the guard play and the length of Dang and some of the other players inside is going to cause too much trouble for Wichita State. And it was a really good run by the Shockers, obviously making the first Final Four since the 50s. Greg Marshall really establishing himself as one of the top coaches in all of college basketball. I'm interested to see what he does there in Wichita over the next few years, or if he stays in Wichita. I said it's a really good move for them and really good representation for the Missouri Valley Conference. But I think Louisville is going to handle that one pretty easily in double digits. But as we've seen, Wichita State is a tough out, so they're going to make it interesting. But I think in the end, you're ultimately going to see Louisville get that win. As far as the other contest, the one I'm looking a little bit more forward to is Michigan and Syracuse. Now, we all know about Syracuse. I applauded and gave a lot of respect to their 2-3 zone in my last podcast, and saying it's probably the most effective defense that I've seen in several years, outside of some of the vintage Arkansas and UNLV pressure defenses of their early 1990s. I don't think I've seen a defense have this much impact as a unit on the offenses of a college basketball team. And when you also include C.J. Fair and Michael Carter-Williams and their contributions, hitting a lot of outside shots and driving to the basket, Syracuse is a formidable opponent. The good news for Michigan, they have several good factors. One, they have John Beilein, who used to coach at West Virginia and faced Syracuse quite often. Granted, he never beat Syracuse or never beat Jim Boeheim, obviously, when he was as a head coach. That's going to cost, and I mean, that's all in the past, though. I think when you look at some of the teams that Beilein has had at West Virginia and some of his other stops, Canisius and many other places, they never had the talent level that he's had now at Michigan to compare to what Syracuse has had over the past 20 or 30 years or so. But he is used to catering an offense to counter against that 2-3 zone. And we said the same thing about Marquette in the regional final in the East, and we saw what happened there, 39 points by the Golden Eagles. So I think that in the end, though, Michigan is going to pull out the victory in this one. I think their offense is clicking right now. Trey Burke, right now, if you had to make a choice of, I guess, the MVP or most outstanding player of the tournament, Trey Burke would be my choice for it so far. They have a lot of good outside shooters with Nick Stukas. He is hitting a lot of three-pointers. Went perfect 6-for-6 against Florida in the regional final. So I think he is going to have some looks against that zone. There are three ways, I think, to beat the zone of Syracuse. Obviously, it's easy to say and write on paper, But I think the actually execute it is difficult. I think the three ways that you do it, one, through outside shooting, and that's very important. And I think Michigan has enough outside shooters to take care of it. Two, you need a good post passer at the free throw line, because that's where you find the hole in the zone. And what's going to happen is you pass the ball in there and you see a collapse. And if you don't have any players that can handle that, that's going to be difficult. And I think that you have guys like Mitch McGarry with the inside play for Michigan is going to be able to handle that assignment, flashing to the post or flashing to the middle of the zone, as they say. And then the third thing is the best way to beat the zone is don't let them set up in it. And I think Michigan's transition offense and the spacing of their three-point shooters, they're going to get some opportunities to run on Syracuse. And I think that's going to be just enough to get past the Orange. And as far as a national title contest between Louisville and Michigan, I'm going to take the Cardinals to win the national championship, win their third national title in school history. Rick Pitino gets his second national title. So I think that the Cardinals are going to win the national championship. But as I said, Syracuse, I think, could pull it off as well. Because the thing about, as I mentioned, all the good things Michigan can do, if their outside shooters aren't hitting, that's going to cause a lot of difficulties for Michigan. And Wichita State, I don't think that they have the least amount of chance, I think, to win the national title. But in this year of parity, where we only have one number one seed in the Final Four, if the Shockers win the national championship, I'm not going to use the puns that I've seen on Twitter and Facebook and all the outlets. It would be surprising. It would not be like the nickname of Wichita State. So those are my thoughts on the Final Four that's taking place this weekend. We're going to do our next show probably, we're going to probably do it on Tuesday or Wednesday. So the next show will have some analysis of all the events that are taking place. But if you disagree with my predictions or have any other thoughts on the Final Four, please send me an email to sportsinquirer@gmail.com. You can always go to Twitter. I'm on there as well. And my Twitter handle is sportsinquirer. And finally, just head to the website itself, thesportsinquirer@gmail.com. I'm going to take a little break here right now. And next, when I come back, I'm going to go into my MMA power rankings for, I guess, the late March, early April, here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. If it's the Easter season or the fact that we've had the NCAA basketball tournament going on, both on the men's and women's side, or even opening a Major League Baseball. But it seems like we've been lacking in major mixed martial arts events over the past few weeks. I know Bellator has been going strong with their events on Spike every Thursday night. We had the World Series of Fighting about a month ago, 3 weeks ago. But besides that, it's been pretty light on that front. So I'm going to go over my power rankings, but it seems like a lot of them stayed the same in most of these categories since the month of February. And I think the reason for that is, one, a lot of these guys aren't fighting or haven't fought in the past few months. And two, we're really going to see a lot of changes in that coming up in the next few months. So it's kind of like a lull period right now for it overall. But I'll go over my rankings anyway. We'll start with the big boys at heavyweight. My number five guy is a man who scored that big upset, maybe the upset of the year, arguably, so far. And that's going to be Antonio Bigfoot Silva, who got that big win over Alistair Overeem a few months ago. So he's my number five guy. Fabricio Werdum is number four. Daniel Cormier, the man who is getting his big shot coming up in May. He's fighting Frank Mir in April, excuse me. So he is going to get a chance to really prove himself in the UFC brand. And if he gets that victory, he's most likely going to face either Junior Dos Santos or Cain Velasquez. And obviously you have Dos Santos at number two and Cain Velasquez at number one. So as far as the next few months start coming up, I think April's a big month because I say you have Cormier facing Frank Mir, and that's going to be very interesting. Also, Dos Santos is facing Mark Hunt. So I think you're looking at maybe a semifinal for the future Cain Velasquez fight if he gets past Antonio Silva. So I think if you see Cormier beat up Frank Mir pretty good, he may get the next title shot heading into the later part of 2013, especially with his Strikeforce Grand Prix championship. And besides, we've seen Velasquez face Dos Santos already. They're split 1-1. You can save that rematch for a later day. Now, if Mark Hunt beats Dos Santos, that's always a tricky wild card there. I don't know if Mark Hunt gets that shot at the crown, but we'll see what happens there. And then on outside of the top five, Alistair Overeem, who has really not distinguished himself very well over the past month or so. Obviously, with the loss to Antonio Silva and then having to pull out of his next matchup due to injury. So that's not a really good time for him. Moving to the light heavyweights, for a division that usually has a lot of fluidity, I think you're starting to see a lot of stability taking place. Number five, I have Alex Gustafsson, who I'm really disappointed had to pull out of his UFC on Fuel contest this upcoming week. He's supposed to face Musasi over in Sweden, but I guess he got a cut, and the Swedish Athletic Commission will not allow him to fight. Dana White was very adamant about thinking the fight should have taken place anyway. It's a tough balance between wanting to, and especially with Gustafsson fighting in his home country, obviously there'll be a lot of fans there wanting to support him in that fight, but you also have to look at the safety of the fighter himself. And sometimes you have to get in the way of the fighter to prevent him from having major issues there. So right now he is my number five guy overall. Number four, I have Rashad Evans, who is coming off a disappointing loss himself to Damian Maya. And Dan Henderson's number three, who I thought earned a close victory over Lyoto Machida. That's who I would have gone with as far as the win. But he lost the fight, and because of that, he does drop a little bit in my rankings. So I had him at number two in my last rankings, so Henderson's number three. Number two is Machida. He earned a win, so I have to give him respect, and I put him at number two. And number one, obviously, is John Jones, who is primed to face Chael Sonnen, a middleweight, and in his next title defense later in this month. So light heavyweight division. It's going to be interesting to see, and I assume that John Jones is going to get past Sonnen pretty easily. And if that happens, I don't know what the next step will be for John Jones. Maybe a super fight against one of the other two top guys in the next two divisions I'm going to go over. And you guys know who those are going to be, but we're going to break it down as well. So next we're going to move to middleweight. This one division has really shown a lack of movement overall. I'll name the rest of the guys just for sake of continuity. I have Yushin Okami at number five, Vitor Belfort at number four, Chris Weidman, who is finally going to get his title shot, looks like later this year, actually in July. He's going to get a title shot. I guess the number one guy, Anderson Silva, we'll just put it out there. Number two, I still have Chael Sonnen, and I know he's now fighting as a light heavyweight, at least for this one contest for the title against John Jones. But I expect him to move back down to middleweight. And there actually will be some decent fights for him at middleweight over the next few months after I think Jones handles him pretty easily. But middleweight is Anderson Silva's world. He's also a pound-for-pound top guy in the world. So obviously he's going to be my top middleweight. Moving to the welterweight division, we've had a little bit of movement here because there have been some fights among these guys. Number five, I have Damian Maya. Number four, I have Nick Diaz as my number four guy. Number three, Carlos Condit. Number two, Johnny Hendricks. And obviously number one is George St. Pierre. Now just a breakdown of that that division. Obviously, St. Pierre had a very impressive victory over Nick Diaz last month in UFC 158. And I thought that he dominated that fight pretty handily. Did not get the stoppage. I did not expect him to stop Nick Diaz. But St. Pierre obviously outclassed the Stockton, California fighter. Hendricks got an impressive victory over Carlos Condit. Tough fight there, too. I thought Hendricks was able to get some of those takedowns and using his wrestling skills to eke out the victory. And now Hendricks is going to get his shot at George St. Pierre later this year. So I think this division is kind of shaping itself up, you know, as far as the top five guys. But this division always has a lot of fluctuations, and we'll see what happens over the next few months. Lightweight division. Now, this is going to be an interesting division as well because number five, I have Anthony Pettis, who actually is going to fight for the featherweight title against Jose Aldo in August. So technically, he could have really made a case to fight the winner of my top two fighters in the lightweight division, fight them later in the year, but he chose to face Jose Aldo. So that's interesting moves there. Gray Maynard, consistent fighter, I have at number four. Nate Diaz, number three. Diaz gave a really good run against Benson Henderson for the title. Just came up short, but he's still right there at number three. Number two is kind of a slightly controversial pick. I have Gil Melendez at number two. I say controversial because if you look at the quality of fighters that he has faced in comparison to Benson Henderson, who's my number one guy, and you compare it to Diaz, Nate Diaz, Maynard, and Pettis, The weakest, I guess, resume would be for Gil Melendez because he fought in Strikeforce and the top lightweight fighters have been in the UFC for the past few years. But he's finally going to get his shot moving to the UFC. He's going to face Benson Henderson in later on this month, in fact, in April. April's a really packed month as far as fights going on. So we're going to finally see Melendez in a major spot fighting for the crown. So those are my rankings for the various divisions. I just ranked those. I didn't really get into some of the other divisions because I didn't see much fluidity or changes from what I did in my last month in the rankings. But like I said, we have some good fights coming up over the next month or so. Within this month, we have that Gil Melendez Benson Henderson fight, John Jones versus Chael Sonnen. We have Ultimate Fighter finale. Those are always entertaining for their own reasons. And also I said Frank Cormier versus Frank Mir. So, and Dos Santos versus Mark Hunt. So, April is a loaded month as far as fights go. So, I'm really looking forward to that. So, I just want to get those rankings in there for you. So, until then, we'll do another ranking probably in the next few months or so. So, right now, we're going to take another break here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. And when I come back, I'm going to go into detail about the firing of Mike Rice and what it means for the coach, athlete, and administrator relationship in college sports in 2013. Big story in the world of sports for the past few days, besides the opening day of Major League Baseball and just one or two other things, was the firing of Mike Rice from Rutgers, the head men's basketball coach. Interesting one about this situation. About 2 days ago, I think it was Tuesday. Yes, it was Tuesday. I was in the gym, you know, in the elliptical, trying to get in spring break / summer shape as usual. And at my gym, you actually have a TV that plays some of the stations that you want to watch while you're running or doing whatever. And I had the elliptical on. I usually turn it to ESPN. And Outside the Lines was on. Usually Outside the Lines, as far as all of the ESPN shows, is one of my favorite shows. I'm dorky about several things in sports. I really get obsessive about uniforms, if you haven't noticed. I like sports business. And I also like investigative reporting. Maybe it's the 60 Minutes fan in me, or your national news on your weekly news, things like that. So I like seeing those shows. Just things literally outside of the field or off the field. So I actually had to stay at the show on, and I was going to change the channel, and I usually have it on mute because I'm listening to some music while or other podcasts while I'm working out. And I just see this one coach going berserk on the practice court, throwing basketballs at players. They showed the captions of what he was saying, using inflammatory anti-homosexual terms, and calling them the bad words we all know out there. Words I guess technically I could say on the podcast because we are uncensored, but I just don't feel comfortable. I never say them in personal life, and I won't do it professionally. But point being, just a coach going off and looking really very disrespectful. And I was like, who is that coach? It looked like one of those old like spoofs or something that you would see someone make up of how not to be a head coach. Sure enough, the story continued, and it was Mike Rice at Rutgers. And being from the Northeast, I know about Rutgers a little bit. I know about Mike Rice a little bit. He's been a coach in that area for a while. But seeing all of that action was very shocking. And I've always said about coaches and players, I think if this whole generational thing, these older gentlemen who are like, back when I was a coach called me MF and every four-letter word out there and questioned my sexuality and used all that stuff and grabbed my face mask and would literally shove me and stuff. I don't think that should be done in general. People say, oh, it shouldn't be done, you know, in this day and age in 2013 with this generation. It shouldn't be done in any generation. There are ways to get your message across without using verbal or physical abuse. And trust me, I've been around coaches that have used a bad word or so, and I was uncomfortable with that. And I've always said, if I was a player, I would not respond to that. You can coach hard. And that was the other thing, is like, people make it seem like you can't coach hard without being aggressive or without being condescending to your players. That's not true. There are plenty of ways to coach hard, and there are a lot of good coaches out there that do that. But back to the special itself and watching the expose, I knew that he was in trouble, and at that point. And then they brought on the Rutgers athletic director, Tom Pernetti, and he stated that he was aware of the videos and what happened, and he got suspended for, I think, 3 games and got fined some money from his contract for what happened. And for that point, I knew that the whole organization was in trouble, because you cannot have a coach treat his players like that on any level, from Pee Wee League all the way to professional leagues and beyond, but especially in college, where these are still, while they're men, true, they're still younger men. You have eight men, 18 to 22, that should not be disrespected in that way. And looking at this situation, it really shows the dynamic. I think you're starting to see the layers slowly come off of the relationship between administrators, coaches, and the media. From the coach-administrator relationship, I think it's going to be more and more difficult to protect your coach or protect your organization from scrutiny. Obviously, we're a little more a year away from all of the Jerry Sandusky Penn State situation. And while this is not as, they're different situations, I don't even want to compare them overall. But what I will compare, though, or analyze, is how you would have situations like Penn State with the protection of administrators. When I say protection of coaches, assistant coaches, head coaches, or even administrators by a university, that's not going to be able to be pulled off now, where you have people with access to technology and videos. I would say 20, 30 years ago, one, the situations probably happened a lot more, how Mike Rice was treating his players. And two, it would not have been exposed into the national limelight. And we've all heard the stories of legendary Hall of Fame coaches with these antics, especially a certain one in the state of Indiana who coached a men's basketball team there for a long time, and how his actions were similar to this, yet he was able to keep his position. I don't think you're going to be able to pull that off anymore. And while Mike Rice has been fired, Tom Pernetti should be very concerned as well. Because when you have a situation like this, while ESPN, as big as it is, it's still, and it's going to be hard to say because you're listening to a sports podcast, and I'm a sports fan too, it's still niche. It's still not mainstream in comparison to other things. Now, when I turn on CNN and even Inside Edition on CBS, like I did last night, or even when I saw that this morning at the gym, when you start seeing a sports story like this cross over into the tabloid shows, and when it's addressed on a CNN or Fox News, that's when you're really in trouble, because that's when you get pressure from outside sources, and that's where you're going to have donors of Rutgers and alumni, or even people in the Northeast or the state of New Jersey, fans of Rutgers. You're going to have them shed a negative light, or they don't like to see their university shed a negative light and have this guy at the helm of it. And then finally, while I've gone into all of these points about what's gone on with Mike Rice's firing and how this may be the layers of deception and the lack of accountability happening, that's not going to take place as much anymore in 2013. The reality is it was much easier for Rutgers to fire Rice because he never finished above 500 in his three seasons at Rutgers. His best Big East record while he was there was 6-12. And that's where you have a lot of these administrators and a lot of these presidents, they can let this stuff go by a lot easier. And honestly, if we really look deep into our souls as sports fans, we let a lot more go if our program or our team is winning. So if Mike Rice was in a situation where his team was contending for a Big East championship, or recruiting high level of talent, and even filling up the rack, the Rutgers Athletic Complex, the rack is where they play their games. If he was able to fill those arenas up and was able to get Rutgers a national name, I don't know if he would have been fired by Rutgers. Because at that situation, you can say, oh, well, you know, it's a mistake, we're going to put him in account, all the excuses, go to counseling, going to get some training, maybe suspend him for the first few games of next season. I don't think you're able to pull that off as much now. I mean, as far as Rutgers being able to pull it off, because he did not win enough. So that was an interesting situation there, and seeing all the reaction out there for what happened with Mike Rice. And I've always said, and you know, you look at it from hypothetical situations, you always put I don't have any children, but you look at your son or daughter, or I have nieces and nephews that play at a college, high school level, and you look at it that, you know, that way. It's like, what if I saw a coach treating them like that? And it would take a lot for me not to physically assault that coach if he was treating my nieces or nephews or cousins in that way. So I said, if that's my reaction to it, then I know what a lot of your reactions are to it as well. And as I said, you don't have to be physical or verbally abusive. And that's another thing too. Well, the physical abuse, the throwing of the basketballs and shoving the players, that obviously is a more visual form of abuse and very tangible with the videos. Verbal abuse is just as bad as well. I mean, the F words that he was using to berate the players was appalling. And that's just as bad as the physical abuse, you know, as well. So when we look at future situations, we can't just look at the, we always hear about the physical stories and what happened there. We got to listen to what the coaches are saying as well and be very careful with that. So those are my thoughts on the Mike Rice firing by Rutgers over the past few days. And of course, if you have any reactions to that, you can send me an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com or go over to the website at thesportsinquirer.net and send your reactions and thoughts to it as well. And also on Facebook under the Sports Inquirer. I'm always there. I log on every day. I'm on there constantly. So always looking forward to hear from all of you out there. Going to take our last break of the show. And when I come back, I'm going to talk about some miscellaneous news and notes in the world of sports here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. Welcome back to the Sports Inquirer podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Portut, once again. Let's get to some miscellaneous news and notes in the world of sports that took place since our last show. The Brittany Griner to the NBA talk. As a fan of women athletics and having a niece who is very involved in women's basketball at the high school level, I do follow the game as much as I can. And while Brittany Griner's talents are outstanding for the women's game, a 6'8 player, dunks the ball, actually has a drop step, can hit an outside jumper. Outstanding player. We need to table the talks of her playing professionally in a men's league. I don't think there is shame in her trying for it. And if she made an attempt, I guess you can't bar her from it. And there's, if you want, she wants to try out or anything like that. I just don't think that it's going to be a feasible option for her. There are still flaws in her game, in the women's game, as far as what she can do. Obviously, she's an outstanding talent. She stays healthy, going to have an outstanding career, win multiple championships at the Olympic level, probably in the WNBA and such. But the men's game is a different level. Her height is her biggest strength in women's basketball. She plays on the post. If she played her same game in the college and in the professional league, in the NBA, or even the NBDL, or even some European leagues as well, she would get dominated by 6'10" to 7-foot men who would be taller than her and physically stronger. And then if she tries to go outside, she's not quick enough to really deal with small forwards or even guards that she would have to deal with who are comparable to her height and her athleticism. So I think that the talk is always, it's always interesting, and you really see some interesting people have a way in it. Mark Cuban's made comments, Gino Auriemma. I've seen that Nancy Lieberman has made her thoughts as well, and Nancy Lieberman is a really good source. She has made that attempt at playing in a men's professional league and had some moments on that level as well. But as far as her going to the NBA, I don't see that happening. It's just some good conversation, I guess, and good talk. Especially since Baylor is now out of the tournament and she is now going to be a professional. Now, Yu Darvish almost perfect game against Houston really propels as a good sign for Texas. We've made fun of the Houston Astros when I had my special guest Spencer Harris of Sports Minds of America. We previewed the AL West and talked about Houston having the worst record, or predicting to have the worst record by far this season. I felt kind of bad about that, but hey, when I do my picks, it's a business. I don't play games. And you obviously saw that with the Houston. If there's going to be a team that gets no hit multiple times this year, it's going to be the Astros. But he is going to have a special year. I don't know if the offense is going to help him get to those 20 wins. While they do score some runs in Texas, I think they've lost something as far as the offense overall. But he's going to have a special year overall. I mean, when he has five or six pitches in his arsenal, literally, that he can throw at any time and any count and is not afraid to use them. So seeing his performance in that game against Houston was outstanding. And really not too many other major league thoughts or opening day thoughts. The first week is always tricky. And as I stated in the last podcast, you're going to have people think, oh, Bryce Harper's going to hit 70 home runs. Clayton Kershaw's going to get 25 wins. You know, the Mets may make the playoffs. Fingers crossed. You know, things like, or the Yankees are going to lose 100 games. None of those things are going to happen, obviously. So we got to temper our enthusiasm for it. But it is good seeing baseball back in full form. And I've actually watched a decent amount of Braves games. I like the excitement. Maybe it's the Upton brothers or my fan crush on Jason Haywood being here in Atlanta. But I am really enjoying watching the Braves play this season. As a matter of fact, after this podcast is concluded, I'm going to turn the TV on and watch the game against the Phillies again tonight. They're going for the sweep. So there is excitement in, I think, baseball with all of the young talent. And that young talent breakdown is coming. I promised it to you a few weeks ago when I was doing the previews. That's still going to take place. We've just had a lot of other sports take place that are towards a conclusion. Some playoff runs are about to happen. So we're going to actually do that baseball breakdown, that young player breakdown, probably in the next week or two. So really look forward to getting that going. Saw that the Big East is now going to be called the American Athletic Conference. Whatever. They may as well just trade Conference USA. The Big East, they just need to trade names or something, because I'm looking at the current roster, the current list of teams that are going to be in the American Athletic Conference. We have Rutgers, Louisville, Connecticut, South Florida, Cincinnati, Central Florida, Memphis, Houston, SMU, and Temple. Rutgers and Louisville are leaving after 2013. And guess who's going to replace them? Tulane, East Carolina, and Tulsa. So pretty much the only teams that are going to be in the holdover from the Big East in 2 years is going to be Connecticut, Cincinnati, and South Florida. I guess Temple, too. It's going to be a holdover from the Big East from now to in 2 years. And all those teams I mentioned that are going to be in the new conference, they're all old Conference USA teams. So watching the Central Florida situation up close and personal, I have a relative that is an athlete at Central Florida, and seeing all of the moves and the excitement of moving to the Big East, get that automatic BCS opportunity if you win the conference, that's going to go away in the next few years, and then you're going to be right back to square one as far as being considered a mid-major. So I don't know what these moves are and how it's going to impact things, especially with the Catholic Seven, I guess, starting next year and merging with some other teams. So this conference realignment, all I just do is sit back and see what happens there. That was something that happened. On the sports business side, interesting move here. Jay-Z, Sean Carter, the famous rapper, part owner of the Brooklyn Nets, the NBA team, and that's an important distinction when we get to the rest of my thoughts on this. The part owner of an NBA team has merged with Creative Artists Agency. I just call them CAA, a major firm that has a lot of agents of players. The big news is that Robinson Cano, who has been represented for numerous years by super agent Scott Boras, is leaving him this season, or leaving him now, and joining up with Creative Artists CAA and Jay-Z and the Roc Nation under the Roc Nation banner. The interesting thing about Robinson Cano is that he is going to be the premier free agent at the end of this season in all of baseball. He's going to command probably $160 to $180 million long-term deal by the Yankees or somebody else. So this is their big splash for Jay-Z into that. Now, actually, Robinson Cano is going to be represented by, I guess, Tom Con. No, he's going to be with Jay-Z. The next guy to talk about is Victor Cruz. the star wide receiver for the New York Giants. And he is going to be represented by CAA as well, and their renowned agent, Tom Condon. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with player agent, NFL players and their agents, Tom Condon's list includes Eli Manning, Drew Brees, Matt Ryan, Tony Romo, Matthew Stafford, Robert Griffin III, all the major most of the major quarterbacks out there, and a bunch of others. So this was a surprising move as well. It was interesting because you always see Victor Cruz being a New York guy from New Jersey. He always throws out the rock sign, the little triangle delta thing. That's a big Jay-Z hand signal as well after he scores touchdowns. I just find it interesting that you have two major athletes, and Victor Cruz is heading into a contract year himself. You have two major athletes putting themselves with a man, and while you respect Jay-Z, the businessman, with his ownership of the Nets, it's still uncharted territory to just have him represent you. Now, the good part is they have some safeguards with this. Of course, Cano is going to be probably with the major agent. Mentioned that Victor Cruz is with Tom Condon. So it's not like it's not similar to the Master P, Ricky Williams situation. And going back to the late 1990s, all of you younger fans out there, Ricky Williams, the Heisman Trophy winner for University of Texas, top five draft pick by the New Orleans Saints, he ended up being represented by Master P's No Limit, Master P, the rapper from New Orleans. He represented Ricky Williams during their contract negotiations. And on paper, it was one of the worst deals signed in the history of professional sports. Pretty much, it was the equivalent of a base salary. And to reach a respectable amount for someone of a top five talent, and this was, by the way, this was pre-rookie salary cap times for the NFL. Because this was a time where you saw players like, recently Sam Bradford, he signed that $50 million guaranteed deal and everything like that. This was at the time where there were no limits. You had guys signing for $30, $40 million guaranteed money as a top five pick. And Ricky Williams, with his deal, was cool enough. For him to reach those numbers, he probably had to rush for like 1,900 yards, 20, 25 touchdowns. He basically had to break rushing records for his team and on the National Football League level to reach those benchmarks to get even decent money. I think times are different now, obviously, and we know about Jay-Z's businesses with his Ace of Spades, a little liquor company and things like that, and obviously owning the Nets and Rockaware and Def Jam. We go down the list of all the money that guy has made. But from a sports business side, I think you're starting to see players want to get more control over their negotiations. And I've always wondered that about athletes. I understand the need for an agent, I guess, to negotiate your contract, but I think a lot of these athletes don't realize is that the agent works for you, and you hire the agent, and you can fire the agent. I think way too much trust is put into these agents and all these financial people that the players hire. And if you saw the ESPN Broke 30 for 30 documentary, you saw all the pitfalls of these athletes and losing their money. So I respect Robinson Cano and Victor Cruz for getting kind of best of both worlds. You get to be represented by a person who was renowned in multiple platforms of life in Jay-Z, yet you're also with CAA, who are major players and major representatives for athletes of their stature. So I thought that was a really interesting sports thing as well. Last point, I like my late night news as well, and it looks like Jimmy Fallon is going to take over for Jay Leno, I guess, in 2 years, and NBC. Interesting to see all of the tie-ups that happen with that. Personally, I'm a Team Conan. I like Conan O'Brien. And I like Jimmy Fallon, too. He's really grown on me. I watched the first month or so, honestly, just to watch The Roots. I'm a big fan of the hip-hop group. And Fallon really did not impress me by what he was doing. Obviously, and I should have cut him more slack, being his first month or two on a major job. But I think he's really grown into a nice position within NBC. Interesting to see how that translates into the 11:30 time slot and the show moving to New York, or the Tonight Show, which has been L.A.-based for oh man, since the 50s with Jack Parr and Johnny Carson, of course, and now Jay Leno, moving it over to New York. It used to be based in, actually no, I take that back. Here's some Tonight Show knowledge for you guys. The show used to be in New York until Johnny Carson took over, back I think in the early to mid 60s, and then they moved the show to Los Angeles. So Tonight Show has such a Los Angeles vibe to it. It's going to be interesting to see how it translates to New York. And trust me, you can tell a difference between the L.A. shows like Conan's show and Tonight Show and the New York shows like Jimmy Fallon and Late Night with David Letterman. Even Jimmy Kimmel's show on ABC based in Los Angeles. You can definitely tell the differences. So at 11:30, I always think of it as an L.A. time. But we'll see what happens there. And there's a really cool link on Grantland.com, which I am going over right now, of all the potential replacements that they want to see. Like Bill Simmons wants Alec Baldwin. Andy Greenwald wants Tracy Morgan. We'll go down the line. Mark Maron, I think, would be a really good choice. All you podcast fans out there, Mark Maron's is one of my favorite ones. So he's a comedian. And we'll go down the line. Tina Fey, Amy Poehler. The Andy Cohen story, I've heard about the Andy Cohen rumors even before this went down. Andy Cohen, who hosts the Bravo late night show, he's a really talented guy. I've heard him rumored to be with, he was in the running, I think, for the Kelly Ripa, Live with Kelly, and now Michael Strahan show. I've seen a bunch of rumors with him, so I could definitely see that being a potential situation. And going down the line to a bunch of other people. But I'm really looking forward to seeing how that all shapes up there. So those are my miscellaneous thoughts on things that I have been following over the past few days. Now we're going to get to what has been ruffling my feathers. So this past Sunday was Easter, or Resurrection Day, or a bunch of other terms out there. Driving around on Sunday after having some family time at the church and everything like that, I actually was in, I was flipping around the different radio stations, and I heard some gospel music, which obviously is not shocking for what took place for Easter. Was not surprised to see that at all, or listen to that. What was shocking, though, is listening to some auto-tune gospel. Now, I'm going to admit, the whole auto-tune movement, I'm mixed emotions on. I like Peter Frampton. I'm going to admit that. That was the original auto-tuner. All these people talking about T-Pain and Future and all these other rappers. Peter Frampton was the original one with the talking box. So, I have respect. I do like the Peter Frampton. I do like the Do You Know How It Feels, or Do You Know, all that stuff. I do like that music. But I don't want to hear that with my gospel music. Now, to be fair, we shouldn't look at gospel music as something that should be archaic and just played with the organ and things like that. There's gospel rap. There's gospel rock. I've listened to some Stryper in my day. I do like some POD. I'm familiar with some of the Christian rock artists. I'm familiar with some of that stuff. Especially living in Nashville, where there's a lot of Christian music there as well. So I've heard gospel, I've heard Christian metal, Christian hip-hop, Christian everything. But for some reason, hearing that auto-tune just turned me off to it. And I think it's more of a representation of the way music is turning these days. If you were following me on Facebook, I was on a big folk music fix. I go through phases where all I listen to is probably my favorite group ever, the Mars Volta. There'll be days where I'm listening to some old school hip hop. You've been hearing a lot of Nas instrumentals. I've been hitting up on that, or some of the younger artists like Joey Badass, who I'm feeling a young rapper out of New York. So when I go through these, and I go listen to all of his stuff, I go through phases. And I've been on a big folk music phase. Listen to some good Crosby, Stills, Nash. some good early Eagles music and Neil Young's, listen to all of Live from Massey. And the lack of production in that, I've just been really impressed with. It's just been some 2-3 guitars, drum set, a lot of acoustic music. So that's the mindset I've been on over the past few weeks. So when I turned on the radio and hear some auto-tuned gospel, that turned me off. And I said, I do like my auto-tune. I like Future. My New York heads are not going to like me saying that. But living down here in the Southeast, is very hard to avoid the Future, Future's music. The rapper, T-Pain, I'm kind of up and down with him. But the point is, I've listened to auto-tuned music, and I've kind of accepted it. But I still like to see some of that old school music, and that's where my other side of me, I like the things like the Black Keys and the Black Angels and some of that stuff, and Death from Above 1979, stuff like that. Very just grimy, simple. Why should I say simple? That's very insulting. But just very primordial like music. And when you put that auto-tune over in Pro Tools, you hear that same drum beat just constantly, that 1, 2, 3, like that. And you musicians out there know what I'm talking about. When you hear that all the time, and that's where you hear a lot of that dance music, that 808, just all the time, it does just become too much. And that's where you have the crossing or the merging of a soulful music. And I can make plenty of jokes about Jesus would not like auto-tune. Or when God created us, I don't think he had a voice box in his mind when he's considering us. Or back in the olden days, with the 12 apostles, would they have been auto-tuned out when they were delivering their messages? Probably not. And I won't go there. But it does show that, I guess, if all musics are going to evolve, and I mentioned all of the Christian music that has evolved over time, we're going to have to accept it. There were times when rock music that we accept now was considered blasphemous. Bob Dylan was booed for using electric guitar. Rap music was considered a fad in like the urban devil's music. And now hip-hop is the biggest music genre out there. So if all of those music evolutions could take place over the past 50 or 60 years, I guess gospel has to, or Christian music, has to join in as well. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. We'll have this show up tonight, and obviously you can listen to it on thesportsinquirer@gmail.com or subscribe to me on AutoTunes under the Sports Inquirer. So every time I update one of these bad boys, you automatically get it into your system, and that makes it easier for all parties involved. I try to make it easy for y'all out there. So next show, we're going to review all of the action from the Final Four down in Atlanta. Probably do my first baseball power rankings since it's going to be a full week of action. See what teams are doing. And all of you hockey fans and NFL fans, I have not forgotten about you. We're going to get to more of that stuff. The NFL is going to be really strong with the NFL draft coming up later on this month. NHL, trade deadline just passed. A lot of moves there. And when we get closer to playoff time, we're going to do some constant analysis of the NHL. So until then, have a good day out there. Stay safe out in the streets. Good fight. Good night.